might go MAGA when more than 60% of white men will vote for Trump.
Yeah, I think the focus on black men has been a complete media, red herring, right? People have been worried about it. I saw a poll recently or post recently saying, like, it looks like Trump's support with black men could be evaporating. Evaporating? It was never there. All right, Trump is going to get the same black men to vote for him who voted for him last time, who voted for him in 2016, who voted for Mitt Romney in 2012, who voted for John McCain in 2008. He's going to get 10 to 15% of the black male vote because there are 10 to 15% of black males are Republicans. And they like Republican things, like shooting Liz Cheney, apparently. That's a Republican thing that apparently a lot of black men, that 15% of black men like. But that's it. And that's always it. And it's never more than that, right? Conversely, we live in a country. Conversely, we live in a country where somewhere around 60% of white men will vote for the adjudicated rapist Donald Trump. And that is our problem in this country, not the 10 to 12 to 15% of black men who are going to vote Republican.
Eli Misdal, we want to thank you for being with us, the nation's justice correspondent. We'll link to all your pieces, including that little secret between Trump and Johnson. Here's what it could mean. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tune in to KBOO every second Sunday of the month, 8 to 10 p.m. for Pacific Northwest Tunes, a show dedicated to showcasing our Pacific Northwest bands and musicians. That's Pacific Northwest Tunes every second Sunday of the month, 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, there was a deadly shooting at Vancouver Mall last night.
Members of Portland City Council aim to end their contract with the Joint Office of Homeless Services.
And in international news, Israeli attacks on Gaza have left the region apocalyptic.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 1st, 2024. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. A person was killed and two others were sent to the hospital last night when a shooter opened fire at the Vancouver Mall during a family trick-or-treating event. Police responded and members of the SWAT team ordered a shelter in place. Authorities later cleared the mall when they determined there was no active threat. The two men who were sent to the hospital have been released after treatment. Officials say they were probably hit by accident after the initial shooting. Surveillance footage shows the shooter was dressed in all black and wearing a clown mask. Eyewitnesses report feeling terror and chaos, with one child saying, quote, "I don't want to die. I don't want to die," end quote. Vancouver police say the shooter is still at large and they are working on identifying the person. They have not confirmed the identity of the man who died or said why he was targeted.
City Council will vote on terminating the Joint Office of Homeless Services agreement with the county on Thursday. In mid-October, Commissioner Renee Gonzalez, backed by Commissioners Mingus Mapps and Dan Ryan, made what city and state officials have called a rash attempt to withdraw from the city and county contract that funds the Joint Office of Homeless Services. The three commissioners will bring the ordinance drafted by the city auditor to city council this Thursday, November 7th at 2 p.m. In July of this year, the city agreed to a three-year-long contract with the city to fund JOHS. This ordinance would break that agreement and initiate a wind-down sequence before another agreement or plan of action is formed. This is also before the impending change in government and city council. The current agreement would finally end in June of 2025, giving the newly voted-in city council and mayor barely 6 months to put a new plan together before funding for services would be terminated entirely. The JOHS is responsible for coordinating and overseeing shelter, outreach, and other services for hundreds of Portlanders. An end to the current agreement without an alternative plan in place would put a halt to, or at least drastically slow down, these vital services. City Council will vote on this item at the November 7th City Council meeting at 2 p.m. Written testimonies may be submitted at the city website. The City Council meeting is held at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue and room 2500. The public can attend City Council meetings in person or online.
Today, two Israeli attacks on residential buildings in Gaza killed 84 Palestinians, including over 50 children. Hamas official Abu Zuri says Hamas is aiming to stop the war of extermination against the people of Gaza and wants a permanent truce. He said they believe that Israel is trying to get their captives home without an end to the war, an idea that Hamas rejects. Abu Zuri added that they believe U.S. is also not interested in a real agreement. Lebanon says Israel is rejecting efforts made to secure a ceasefire after an Israeli airstrike killed at least 24 people in northeastern Lebanon, while the capital, Beirut, was hit by more than 10 deadly Israeli air raids overnight. Seven people, four of which were foreign workers and three were Israelis, were killed in separate Hezbollah attacks in northern Israel. This is the deadliest day in months for civilians in Israel. Israel's genocidal war in Gaza has killed 43,259 Palestinians and wounded 101,827 since October 7th, 2023. An estimated 1,139 people were killed in Israel by Hamas-led attacks on that day. In Lebanon, at least 2,867 people have been killed, and 13,047 have been wounded since this iteration of the war on Gaza began.
Measure 118, or the corporate tax revenue rebate, promises Oregonians more money, but opponents say it comes with a hefty price tag. Antonio Gisbert, the labor organizer who filed the measure, says it will use taxes on big corporations as a universal basic income for Oregonians in the form of a rebate. Corporations already pay either the corporate income tax or the minimum tax, whichever is higher, dependent on their profits for the year. That money goes to the Oregon General Fund, the biennial budget that pays for services like public education, social services, and the kicker. When the revenues exceed a governor-projected estimate, the excess is kicked back to Oregonians as a sort of rebate. Measure 118 would change this structure. Instead of taxing their profits, the measure would tax corporations' sales exceeding $25 million. Instead of going to the general fund, the revenue would be distributed to Oregonians as a refundable tax credit or cash payment, estimated to be $1,600 a year. Gisbert says small businesses end up paying higher tax rates than corporations with higher sales. He argues that giant corporations should be taxed more fairly and that revenue should be redistributed to community members as a way to fight poverty. Proponents of the measure agree, specifically, the financial backers who strongly support universal basic income. Josh Jones, a Californian millionaire who earned his fortune through cryptocurrency, donated $1 million to the Oregon Rebate PAC. In a video he posted on Reddit in early October, he acknowledged the tax would cause inflation, but said that $1,600 rebate is worth it. Dylan Hirsch-Schell, a former Tesla engineer running for San Francisco mayor, donated $100,000 to the Oregon Rebate PAC. He said, quote, "Poverty is fundamentally a lack of money. So what is the most direct and effective way of addressing people? Simple, give people money," end quote. Giselle Huff, another Californian to donate $100,000 to the PAC, helps run the Gerald Huff Fund for Humanity, a nonprofit focused on universal basic income initiatives. Initially, the progressive political parties and unions endorsed this idea as well.
However, an analysis by the Oregon Legislative Revenue Office, LRO, found that Measure 118 would actually cost Oregonians by way of inflation and increased sales tax. In the analysis, LRO found that the measure would result in a negative cash flow. A tax on sales instead of profit could be less than the amount required to fund the rebate program and the rebates themselves. The analysis also found that Oregon would experience a 1.3% increase in inflation, and the sales tax would be around 12%. Since the tax would be 3% on all sales exceeding $25 million, every step of the supply chain would be taxed 3%, eventually falling on the consumer. Higher costs of goods in Oregon would encourage consumers to shop outside of the state, leading to a drop in jobs and economic revenue, the LRO analysis found. A coalition of opponents filled with over 500 corporations, businesses, unions, and elected officials agree that this measure would be bad for Oregon. They highlight that the rebate could be taxed as additional income if the state denies waivers and exemptions filed by the Department of Human Services. Residents receiving government assistance could face a reduction or end in services with the rebate and would have to file for reimbursements with the Department of Revenue. Republicans and Democrats agree that the measure is poorly written and threatens Oregon's economic stability. The Oregon Working Families Party, Democratic Socialists of Eugene, Launa Local 483, and Picayune all withdrew their endorsements over the last few months. Governor Tina Kotek told the Willamette Week, quote, "It may look good on paper, but its flawed approach would punch a huge hole in the state budget and put essential services for low-wage and working families at risk," end quote. If Measure 118 passes, it will be the biggest tax increase in Oregon history.
Harris says her campaign is prepared for Trump to prematurely claim victory. Pennsylvania elections officials say safeguards in the system are preventing vote fraud. And Montana Senate race could hinge on the political refugee vote. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We know that he is actually manipulating the press and attempting to manipulate the consensus of the American people based on fiction instead of fact. We're prepared to respond.
Vice President Kamala Harris tells ABC her campaign is ready if former President Donald Trump prematurely claims victory on election night, just like he did in 2020. Trump has spent months sowing doubts of election integrity and refused to commit to accepting the results, even hinting at political violence if he doesn't win. Trump's most recent target is Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where officials are investigating hundreds of fraudulent voter registration applications submitted by paid canvassers. The applications were rejected, but Trump described it as organized election fraud.
They've already started cheating in Lancaster. They've cheated. We caught them with 2,600 votes.
Pennsylvania election officials say the system is working, including safeguards against fake names included to make a quick buck. Secretary of State Al Schmidt says the nonpartisan election officials are doing their job effectively.
When you have cases like this, it should encourage people to have more faith in the system, not less.
A Pennsylvania judge has ordered an expansion of in-person early voting in a battleground county outside Philadelphia after long lines led to complaints of disenfranchisement. Responding to a lawsuit from the Trump campaign, the judge also extended the application window for mail-in ballot applications in Bucks County. During a campaign stop in Pennsylvania, House Speaker Mike Johnson said if Trump wins, there will be massive reforms to the Affordable Care Act. He told supporters Obamacare could be eliminated as part of an aggressive first 100 days in office.
We want to take a blowtorch to the regulatory state, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, these agencies have been weaponized against the people. It's crushing the free market.
Republicans repeatedly attempted to repeal the ACA during Trump's term, but never found a workable replacement. Campaigns are spending record amounts to win control of the Senate. Observers expect more than $1 billion will be spent by Election Day in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Montana. In Montana, incumbent Democratic Senator John Tester is hoping his support for reproductive rights could give him a needed edge. But University of Montana journalism professor Lee Banville says Tester could be vulnerable to what he calls the political refugee vote, conservatives who moved from blue areas to Montana, which had traditionally been independent.
if Tester loses, it's sort of a statement that actually party identification means more than anything else in the state of Montana, and that is a change from where we used to be.
Recent polls show Tester's opponent, Republican businessman and former Navy SEAL Tim Sheehy, slightly ahead. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Wow, we better play good tonight, huh? Thank you for that nice welcome. Baylor and I are traveling around having some fun. We're putting together the thing that we did a few years ago. We made a recording and wrote some music.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather is chilly, with a low of 50 degrees and lots of showers. Tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy, with showers starting in the afternoon, getting up to 52 degrees. Today in history, the first issue of Ebony magazine was published in 1945, just 2 months after the end of World War II. The inaugural edition featured profiles on writer Richard Wright and jazz singer Hazel Scott, along with defining photojournalism that would set the magazine apart for decades. The quote of the day is from Palestinian writer and political activist Edward Said. He was born on this day in 1935. He said, quote, "Power, after all, is not just military strength. It is the social power that comes from democracy, the cultural power that comes from freedom of expression and research, the personal power that entitles every Arab citizen to feel that he or she is in fact a citizen and not just a sheep in some great shepherd's flock."
Oregon State University collaborates with 9 recognized tribes in the state for repatriation efforts, and a white raven was seen in Anchorage last year, giving many symbolic hope. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The proper repatriation of Native American remains is behind a new facility in Corvallis. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, it's a collaboration between Oregon State University and the 9 federally recognized tribes within the state.
Called the OSU NAGPRA facility, the 2 buildings are about 2,000 square feet total. They're for consultation, records, and storing human remains in accordance with the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. The 1990 federal law mandates the safe return of skeletons, bones, and cultural items to their tribes. Ariel Russell is Director of Natural Resources and Culture for the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lora, Umpqua, and Siosla Indians. She credits sensitive discussions among tribes, OSU, and the state in making this facility possible.
It's just very important to us as tribes to have that relationship and it not be a transactional thing, because these are ancestors. They've made their journey on the other side, and you have to be careful when you navigate those sorts of things.
Other tribal representatives across Oregon have voiced support for the facility, which may be the first built specifically for repatriation purposes. OSU's NAGPRA director, Don Marie Alapisco, was pleased with the support.
This isn't an ending at all. This is a new beginning. This is a change, a shift in how NAGPRA can and should be performed.
NAGPRA compliance has been a constant sore spot between many tribes and institutions. Some universities have retained bones and remains in years past, citing research needs. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
People are still hoping to see a blue-eyed white raven in Anchorage, Alaska, which first appeared in a neighborhood last October, where it became an instant media sensation. The bird was last seen in April. There's no guarantee it will be back, but as KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, there's still hope.
White raven, wherefore art thou? That question echoes across Spinard, where there are plenty of pizza crusts and French fry droppings to tide them over through the winter. Jennifer Olson goes out looking every day.
With my cell phone storage space, which is limited, I managed to amass about 6,500 photos.
Olson says it's hard to let go of a single one of them.
Because each moment is different. Each little look of the eye, a little tilt of the head.
But alas, so far, no white raven. The very first photo posted on the Anchorage White Raven Spotting's Facebook page was on October 24th last year. But Aaron Towarik may have been the first to photograph the bird in Anchorage last year. On October 20th, he took a photo of white raven and its black feathered companion on the roof of an old vacant restaurant.
In some ways, has its own mysticism.
Towarik remembers that moment well. He was living in a Spinard hotel room, waiting to get into alcohol treatment.
And I was just trying to stay active because I was just going through alcohol withdrawal, so I was walking around on Spinard, and that's kind of when I saw it. And it's a good place marker for my personal journey.
Towarik says the sight of the bird inspired him, and on October 23rd, he entered a treatment program. He says things would come full circle for him to see the white raven again. He's wondered how the bird is doing, but if he doesn't see it, that's okay too. He says that's one of the big lessons of sobriety, to learn acceptance.
A lot of the time we want to impose our will on the world, but it's kind of about letting go of the things in your life that you don't have control over.
In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Scientists are thrilled to see Chinook salmon are returning to the upper basin of the Klamath River just 2 months after the largest dam removal project in U.S. history. The researchers have launched a comprehensive strategy to gather data needed to continue to support the fish, the river, and the people who depend on salmon. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Wild Chinook salmon have returned to the upper Klamath River less than 2 months after the largest dam removal project in U.S. history to remove four outdated hydroelectric dams. After 20 years of organizing and legal battles by the Yurok tribe and other groups, 400 miles of historic salmon habitat have reopened. Scientists are now monitoring the effects of the dam removal on salmon populations. Yurok tribe member Amy Bowers Cordalis says they've been astonished by how quickly the migrating fish are returning to areas that haven't supported them for generations.
And all these people are using indigenous knowledge and marrying it with Western modern science to observe and to tell us how the river is healing. And it's really a remarkable opportunity.
Cordalis is also founder of the indigenous conservation group Ridges to Riffles. The data being collected details, among other things, fish spawning locations, their health, and numbers, all of which will be crucial for predicting future populations. Biologist and Yurok tribe member Barry McCovey says for the Yurok, a strong wild salmon population is a fundamental part of their identity and livelihood.
Success has to do with our ability to be indigenous people and practice the way of life that we've done since the beginning of time. Are we able to catch enough fish to feed our elders? Are we able to have enough fish in the river so that we can teach our children to fish?
The dam removal was also done to improve water quality in the Klamath Basin. The research is expected to benefit fisheries and guide further restoration efforts along the river. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Starting in 2 weeks, PBOT will automatically tow cars without visible plates or vehicle identification numbers. In July, PBOT announced that they would be increasing enforcement of parking and vehicle registration in order to combat PBOT budget cuts. Starting Tuesday, November 12th, anyone without a visible license plate and VIN number is now subject to a tow without notice. The VIN number is usually visible on the driver's side of the dashboard where it meets the windshield and should be possible to be read looking in from the windshield. Oregon typically requires vehicles to show two license plates, one on the front and one on the back. There is an exception for vehicles like mopeds and motorcycles, which are only required to display one license plate. An amendment to city code, made in August, backs this change concerning towing without prior notice. The Portland government website says that this new enforcement will help move unlawfully parked vehicles, such as abandoned autos, out of the way quicker. To find out how to get back towed cars, Portlanders must contact Portland Police Auto Records at 503-823-0044. For people who have had their cars stolen, or for some low-income residents, there are towing hardship funds for up to $300.
The November election is just 4 days away, and with such a long ballot and high stakes, the question everyone wants to know is, when will we find out the winners? For the national election and many state and local races, the winner won't be known on election night. In the 2020 election, the presidential race wasn't called for Joe Biden until 4 days after the election. Some states have laws that don't allow them to start counting early votes or mail-in ballots before Election Day. Oregon accepts ballots that are postmarked by Election Day, so that means ballots can be arriving several days after the election. The most important factor in determining when results will be available is the margin between the candidates. The closer the race, the longer it will take to call. For Portland voters using ranked choice voting, the final result can only be determined once every ballot has been counted. That means that on election night, the preliminary rounds of counting will indicate the leader or leaders of the race, not the winners. In order to win the mayoral race, a candidate needs to get 50% of the vote plus one. In order to win a seat on city council, a candidate needs to win 25% of the vote plus one. The first Oregon results will be available at 8 p.m. on election night. How much they'll indicate about the eventual outcome also depends on how many ballots are turned in before 8 p.m. on election night. As of today, the State Elections Division reports that 38% of Oregonians have turned in their ballots so far. Ballots can be returned to official Dropbox locations or put in the mail. They must be postmarked or turned into a Dropbox by 8 p.m. on Election Day.
With Election Day near, major party candidates and civic engagement groups are keeping up with the traditional Get Out the Vote rallies. These events, sometimes featuring popular performers, aren't just limited to big or mid-sized cities far away from tribal communities. A rally geared for Indigenous voters was held in North Dakota this week. Mike Moen reports.
Political rallies and large-scale get-out-the-vote events might conjure images of a packed arena in a major city. But in states like North Dakota, groups that connect with Indigenous voters also are bridging key messaging with entertainment. This week, several hundred people packed a venue at the Spirit Lake Casino in St. Michael, where they retreated to a mix of popular music from well-known regional acts like Scotty Clifford to traditional drum music. It was all part of the Snag the Vote tour moving through the region. Kirsten Kavanaugh of North Dakota Native Vote says between the guitar solos and singing was a reminder to participate in the election.
We're working on getting that information for the voters to just basically have their voices heard.
In the 2018 midterms, North Dakota saw a surge in voter turnout in Indian Country after the state adopted a new restrictive voter ID law, adding to longstanding barriers for people living on reservations. Rallies back then also featured big-name entertainers, but the turnout regressed in 2020 with the effects of COVID-19. Voters are often encouraged to pay attention to local races and not devote all of their time monitoring federal elections. But Kavanaugh says sometimes they have to reverse that order when reaching out to tribal populations, reminding them that the race for the White House affects them too.
And it's just been eye-opening for people where they're starting to be like, okay, yes, I want to be involved. I need to be involved with this.
At this week's Snag the Vote event, organizers gathered more than 250 pledge-to-vote commitments. Kavanaugh says while efforts like these are vital just before an election, North Dakota Native Vote does this type of work year-round. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
As North Carolina rebuilds after Hurricane Helene, misinformation is slowing relief efforts and stirring fear among residents ahead of the election. Environmental advocates warn these false claims are not only hindering recovery, but also adding confusion at a critical time for voters. Shantia Hudson has more on the story.
As North Carolina communities continue to pick up the pieces after Hurricane Helene, they faced a new obstacle, a surge of misinformation that's slowing down crucial relief efforts and leaving residents uncertain about where to turn. Misleading claims are creating confusion, says David Kiva, president of EDF Action, the advocacy arm of the Environmental Defense Fund. Kiva says this adds another layer of difficulty to an already challenging recovery.
They're having a really hard time doing it because of lies that Donald Trump and others are spreading about where relief efforts are focused. I'm sure you saw, but FEMA had to pause their relief work because they were worried that their workers would be subject to attack from militias.
This misinformation has caused widespread anxiety, particularly over claims that FEMA's $750 emergency checks intended to help with immediate food and shelter needs would make recipients ineligible for future aid. Despite being proven false, Kiva says the rumor has discouraged some families from seeking essential support. The challenge isn't limited to North Carolina. Kiva points out similar issues in other states where false information about disaster relief and clean energy policy could threaten future economic growth in some communities. He stresses that moving away from clean energy policies would have stark consequences, especially in states like North Carolina and Pennsylvania.
If we were to move in the opposite direction and take a step back, the successful clean energy policies that we've advanced over the past couple of years, that would cost both states jobs. It would cost both states economies to go in the wrong direction, and it would cost families higher energy bills.
Kiva encourages people to look closely at the facts, question which candidates are being truthful, and to recognize the potential for things like job growth from clean energy. He notes that communities already benefiting from these investments are seeing positive changes, from new factories to improved public health. For North Carolina News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 1st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news.